Take a network break. Get a virtual donut and join us for our weekly analysis of tech news. We've got stories on Arista, Google, AWS, and more. This week's show is sponsored in part by Nokia. Did you know that Apple's using Nokia's data center fabric solution? If you want to know more and learn more about Nokia SR Linux and their fabric services platform for yourself, check out nokia.com/networks/dc-fabric. And we'll tell you a little bit more about that later in the show. After the news, we have a sponsored Tech Bytes conversation with Infoblox about its NetMRI network and configuration management software, provides change control, compliance, and automation capabilities. And if you like Network Break, check out our other podcasts. We've got Day 2 Cloud, Heavy Networking, IPv6 Buzz, and Full Stack Journey. It's nerdy tech analysis and compelling conversations. You can find them all at packetpushers.net. Greg, we got a few FUs from our last show. I wanted to go over a few of them. FU is follow-up, and if you want to follow up on anything we say here, it's packetpushers.net/FU. You can drop us a note. First, a listener wrote in about last week's discussion of the desktop and wall-mounted switches that Cisco announced. He wrote, "You're talking about wireless protocols like Wi-Fi and Zigbee, but missed a real reason to run Ethernet to lighting, and that is to power lights off of PoE. Running lights off of PoE can be a huge money saver, with Ethernet's cheaper per foot than copper power cable, and can be run by low-voltage techs, which in many locations are a lot cheaper by the hour."
Yeah, that was the pitch, except when you go and do the numbers, the electrical cable is in the ceiling already. And a lot of these buildings need the electric cable in the ceiling for other things. So depending on which country you might be in, a lot of people put air conditioners in the ceiling and they actually run it locally. They're not like a building-wide aircon. Mm-hmm. There's a range of other things that need to be done. I'm not saying it's not a good idea. I just thought it was an impractical idea. The idea that the switch is a power supply for LED lights and that your Ethernet switch would then become a centralized controller does make sense if you're looking at it from a networking perspective. But if you then put yourself somewhere else and look at, say, a Hue lights or the, you know, some of the Bluetooth stuff that's in your home, and if there was an industrialized version of that, you wouldn't need any of this. You could just plug it into your existing setup. And you might even use Category 5 cabling, but why plug it into a $10,000 Ethernet switch? Why not just run it to a power supply and then have them wirelessly connected somehow, right? There's no particular reason that wired is better than wireless control. And wireless control has a lot more flexibility and capability. So I just thought it was like, yes, there's a sense to PoE, wired PoE, you're delivering power and the control. But what we also know is that Zigbee and Bluetooth signaling is just as good and probably more flexible and easier to sell to people in the long run because it's got more flexibility.
Yeah, it sounds like this person was coming from a very specific use case. I guess they do a lot of work on hotel rooms and such where they need to power a VoIP phone, for instance. So having a little switch, a wall mount switch that you can, you know, power the phone off that as well, maybe makes sense for this particular use case.
Yeah, well, you know, okay, so niche use cases, right?
Okay.
Yeah, right. So if you're in that, you could do the same argument about a hospital, right? Mm-hmm. Having the telephony system running off a centralized power supply is absolutely desirable for an emergency response because you want to have, just because the electricity's gone out to the hospital or the electricity's fluctuating, you still want people to be able to call through to a central thing and get emergency communication. So the telephone systems in hospitals are radically different.
Right.
I could agree with you. Yes, there are applications, but we're talking about a much wider thing. That doesn't mean it's not practical for certain niche use cases, but it's certainly not practical for the wider community. If you think a generic WeWork office is going to be flood-wired with Ethernet-powered lights, I think you'd be on the wrong track. And keep in mind, they've been pushing the idea of PoE for desktops, so there's been various thin client computers that would run off PoE, the 90-watt PoE versions, not really taken off. Like, there's some deployments of that, but it's not universal. You know, what we are seeing, though, is people putting USB jacks on desks so that people can plug in their phones and iPads and computers.
Right.
Not exactly PoE, if you know what I'm saying.
Right.
So until you actually get to the point where Apple ships its Macs, for example, or Dell ships its and says we can take line-powered phones and computers, I don't think PoE, power over Ethernet, is a thing because it's much more likely that you're going to deliver power over USB.
Right, for desktop and wall mount use cases in particular.
Yeah, and that ship has sailed. You know, MacBooks already charge off USB-C. That means you can charge them off any, you know, plug pack with a USB in it of any sort, A, C, whatever. Mm-hmm. You can charge them off a battery, just a conventional, any battery with a USB-C cable, boom, you can charge your laptop. that boat has sailed. Nobody is going to start using the Ethernet jack to charge laptops and phones at this point.
Right. Yeah, I think with Cisco rolling out those little mini switches was less about we're going to conquer the world with this, but we have one of everything in the portfolio. And if you've got a use case like a hotel room use case, then Cisco's ready to sell them to you.
And people did queue up to tell me about the hotel use case. So obviously, 10 years ago, there was a thing called 3Com NJack, which was exactly this, the switch in the in the jack. HPE has one today. And in fact, I think it was 4 or 5 years ago, they were telling us about it in the context of a Wi-Fi network. They produced a wall jack, which looked like a bit of a blind, but inside of it was a wireless that would fill the room with a suitable wireless. And then it had an Ethernet port running away so that you could actually do high quality Wi-Fi to every room. And it was built for a particular customer. I believe it was Hilton, but I could be wrong, but like a well-known hotel chain. People also pointed out that UBNT has the same thing. Yeah, so this isn't a new idea. So thanks to everybody who pointed. What I pointed out was from Ethernet's point of the point of the story was that Cisco's sort of catching up with the other place in the market. And the thing that I didn't make enough of was that this is related to its SD access strategy. Mm-hmm. The idea is that these switches come up, report home to the Cisco's SD access controller, part of their campus, part of their Lisp. Micro-segmentation, security play. So if you're into that, this is that. If you're into flooding a hotel with just internet access, you probably wouldn't be buying the Cisco thing because I suspect the pricing and the licensing model wouldn't be as effective as these other alternatives.
Right. One more FU. On our last show, we had a tech bite about Aruba Fabric Composer. That is data center software for provisioning your underlay and overlay automatically. And one of the features of Fabric Composer is that it can tie into Nutanix and VMware. So you can do things like get visibility into your virtual infrastructure or allow even VM admins to do a little bit of networking with some controls in place. And somebody wrote in to say, does this mean HPE has finally killed their own HCI product, SimpliVity, given the Nutanix and VMware integration? No, SimpliVity is still a going concern. HPE is still putting resources behind it. I think this integration is more recognition of, you know, the state of the market and wanting to hook in a customer with whatever they have. So if they're a VMware shop, then Fabric Composer can still fit there. They don't have to just tie to SimpliVity.
Yeah, exactly. So a Fabric Composer is the switching infrastructure between your SimpliVities. So when you buy a SimpliVity, you get a switch at the top of the rack, unless you're buying it as a GreenLake, which is different. But I would expect if you're getting a GreenLake deployment, you may find that you've got the GreenLake stuff uses whatever it uses, which is normally SimpliVity or whatever the version of GreenLake that you buy, that you choose to rent. But you still need a network to connect everything together. So if you've got a data center and you've still got, you know, 500 machines or 200 machines, and you still need a backbone network, the Rubik Fabric Composer is the way to connect those together, as opposed to SimpliVity is the servers and a switch at the top of the rack. Like most hyperconverged infrastructures, they don't sell you the backbone of the data center, although they're trying to.
Yes.
Yeah.
They always try.
Yeah. So I would imagine if you were an existing HPE, you know, if you'd been I would imagine that if you had partnered with HPE to date, you would have a cluster of HPE servers all around, and you've got a network. Maybe it's not HPE, maybe it's, you know, some other brand. And HPE is now saying, well, we've got a product that can replace that existing network, would integrate tightly with SimpliVity, and potentially be a part of a GreenLake acquisition where you could migrate away from that legacy to this, you know, on-demand, pre-purchase capacity. They'll deliver the components according to what you need, and you pay by the month for it. So.
Right.
That's how I would sort of envisage this playing out in reality. We didn't sort of touch on that. So.
No, we didn't. And I think it's also a recognition that if you're a big company like HPE and you've got a networking business, that network has to acknowledge that other products, other HCI products exist, like Nutanix and VMware. And so to not integrate with them would be a mistake. So it's one of those, you know, we've got to cooperate and compete at the same time.
Yeah, I definitely think HCI, have always been convinced that HCI is broadly the way forward for modern data centers. That gives you the same functionality you get of the cloud, public cloud, you know, VMs on demand, click a button, and you can scale them out, at least in principle, right? That, and get your flexibility that you need. And the storage is shared, the compute is shared. You may have some legacy stuff in the corner that does something specific. You may have, you know, something that needs a particular backup strategy or an RPO type stuff, and maybe that runs on a legacy array because but generally HCI will be the way forward. And over time, as applications update, you'll be able to build cloud-like services out of HCI. So we've seen VMware go in this direction where they don't just provide the HCIs, they also provide the apps that go into like delivering cloud services. So now they have Kubernetes, now they have a blockchain product, now they have a, you're going to see more and more of that.
All right, well, let's now transition to the news portion. And if during this news portion you hear something you want to correct or comment on, you can always hit us up, packetpushers.net/FU. We do love your feedback. First, starting off with Arista, they are dipping their toe into the zero trust waters. They've got a new offering called MSS Group. And at a high level, it's essentially letting administrators create network access policies based on a device's group membership. So, for example, an IoT group, a guest group, a human resources group, and then make sure devices within those groups are only allowed to connect to appropriate systems like an IoT camera to a video server.
So micro-segmentation, every time you hear zero trust, you want to be thinking about how micro-segmentation is done is the first thing.
Yep.
And then the second part is how do you admit things to the micro-segments? So in days gone by, we used to do admission to micro-segmentation, VLANs, VERFs, you know, whatever, with access lists or by physical controls. This server plugs into this port on the switch, it's in this VERF, right, for example.
Right.
The zero trust is the same thing in principle, but the question now is, how do I bring together a network which I actually don't trust much of the physical infrastructure, or the things that connect to my network may well be wired or wireless, and they may not be inside the network, they may be outside the network. And I think Arista's journey is the right part here. They don't actually have all the pieces. Did you?
Yes, that's very much the case, that this is the first step, I think, on a larger zero trust journey for Arista. This is kind of their toe in the water. They don't have all the pieces. What they have is, it's essentially, they've got two components. They've got the EOS switches, they're using those for enforcement points, and they've got CloudVision, which is their essentially switch management, switch controller, and CloudVision serves as the policy point. It's where you put in, you define all your groups, you say, you know, folks associated with this subnet should be in this group, and here's the policy, and then CloudVision pushes that policy down to the EOS switches. What they don't really have is that device fingerprinting capability, and so at the outset, they're partnering with Forescout for that.
Well, yeah, Forescout, and probably the best way to describe Forescout is that they're able to fingerprint edge endpoints. They have this database where they're able to examine all of the devices in networks, and they're able to fingerprint it and say, oh, that's a printer, that's a fax machine, that's a, you know, an IoT device, that's a light switch, whatever.
Yep.
And that provides the critical information about how do I allocate a device to a microsegment.
Right.
So Arista's key claim to fame here is that they're using a multi-domain segmentation. Now, Cisco, of course, uses security group tags, which is a proprietary tag that they add to the Ethernet frame.
Right.
And the problem with this, of course, is that a lot of switches don't actually like security group tags. They won't forward them because that's a non-standard Ethernet implementation. Some switches do, some switches don't. And by and large, Cisco's SGT is proprietary to Cisco. Only Cisco's products recognize it, only its and its partners have limited access to what they can do with that. And then once you've got a group tag, they use the Lisp protocol, which is arcanely complicated. It's not a very – and so Arista's sort of hinting at it in its documentation without actually mentioning the words SD Campus and Lisp and all that sort of stuff. But the pointing is they're saying they're using standard switching tools. That is, if we know what a device is, then we can look at the header pattern, so the SIS address, the destination address, the MAC address, and that sort of stuff, and put rules in the device dynamically and just use standard Ethernet forwarding. There's no need to do Lisp if you have a standard SDN controller that can do all the pattern matching.
Right, exactly. They made it very clear that they're not fussing with Ethernet. They're not adding any kind of proprietary tagging to Ethernet. It's pure Ethernet frames is what they're sending through the network. What they did do was have to update their ASICs in their software so they can still do some kind of tagging, but it happens at the ASIC level as opposed to the Ethernet level.
Yeah, that's right. They build a tag based out of the rules that they see as the destination MAC, source MAC, destination IP.
Right.
Very open flow.
It does sound a little bit open flowy now that you say that, yes.
Yeah. If I match this, I'll put a tag in it. No, that's what MPLS does, right? MPLS says traffic coming in. If it matches this, I'll put a tag in it.
Exactly.
So the whole idea is not new. What's new here is they're using software-defined networking to do it without attempting to sort of take over from other things that go on here. So I think Cisco's doing, Arista's doing the best it can with what it's got. But if you look at the competitive market here, I think customers expect them to provide the whole thing. They don't want to go to Arista and buy Arista switches and then go to another company and buy the fingerprinting solution, go to another company and buy an identity management. Because another way to do this is identity management. When the user connects to the network, can I fingerprint the device through identity, log in, where they are, who they are, you know, that sort of stuff.
Yeah, Arista was hinting at maybe they're going to be partnering with like an Aruba using their ClearPass infrastructure, their Radius infrastructure to do that kind of thing. But again, this is the first effort. And so their first partner out of the gate is Forescout. And yes, I agree, they're missing that device identity component. I think the other issue with this first effort from Arista is that if you're building it from scratch and you don't have a Forescout, then you're essentially building these policies on your own in CloudVision. Essentially from scratch, they can't import any existing sort of groupings you might already have, which seems like making extra work for you at the outset.
Yeah. I also get the sense that Arista's sort of falling behind here, don't you? It's like, that, you know, I mean, Arista doesn't charge ahead at the forefront. Generally, what they do is they tend to do well. But this was always needed in the campus, and it feels to me like this is better late than never. But late.
Yeah, I mean, I guess I would also say on the flip side, zero trust implementations that we've heard about and talked to other vendors about, they can be incredibly complex, right? And it's a lot to bite off all at once. And so the other way to look at this is that Arista is saying, we've got a solution, it's pretty bare bones, but you can also get your arms around it. And as a first step into zero trust, you can start to build out a little bit of an infrastructure, start off with just IoT devices, start off with whatever thing you're most worried about, build segmentation for that, and then go from there, so you don't have to try to swallow everything all at once. So if you look at it from a different perspective, that this is a little bit maybe more easier to consume than going out, going whole hog on a full zero trust package, maybe that's a useful way to get this into organizations who are already invested in Arista in the first place.
Yeah, and then the second part is, do we actually care about the network? Do we actually care about the switches? Like, if we're in a post-campus era, what I really want is, I don't actually want to classify them when they connect to my network. I actually want to classify them when they're at home or where they are on the internet. Mm-hmm. So this solution has to be highly integrated with a VPN or a software-defined perimeter solution, whether it's SD-WAN or some sort of, you know, we're talking to a lot of companies about their software-defined perimeter, some of them with really thin clients that send the data off to a cloud infrastructure to be scanned and to be segmented, and others which run a very thick client at the edge, and it does a lot of the security scanning and so forth at the device at the edge. If you're doing that, this has less value.
It does, right? Mm. Yeah, yeah.
This is kind of what we did before. Yeah,
in terms of remote access, Arista is, I think, significantly further behind their competitors.
Well, you know, if your only tool's a hammer, every problem looks like a nail. You sell a switch and a router.
Right. What they sell are campus switches and data center switches. Yeah.
That's it. And so the limitations of that product portfolio, they've added some security functions, but again, security on top of switches and routers, you know, on top of those, you know, Broadcom, the ASICs that are inside of their switches, usually Broadcom. You know, they don't have too much software. They have some of their Arista EOS can be delivered in software if you want. Obviously, the acquisition of Big Switch gives them a multi-cloud portfolio. Mm-hmm. We haven't seen, I think that's still in transition as they digest the acquisition and repackage it, ready to come out. So yeah, I do feel like the market's moving perhaps quicker than Arista can, certainly, but equally the same is true of Cisco as well.
Right.
And, you know, whatever, Aruba's being much more fluid and dynamic as it moves, I think.
Yeah, well, I think we're well positioned because of their approach to the market anyway. So, links in the show notes if you want to find out more. I think we'll be hearing more from Arista about Zero Trust down the line. But yeah, it is a very fluid market at this point, given the changes in remote access and the workforce. So we'll see how they react. Let's move on. Google Stadia is shutting down its in-house game development studio. If you're not familiar with Stadia, it's a game streaming service from Google. It's supposed to compete with consoles such as Xbox and PlayStation, that is, stream your games over the internet instead of running them off a console. And when Google launched Stadia, a key element of that strategy was to create exclusive games to run on its own service, which would sort of draw people to the service. But they've realized that making games is very hard, and now they've shut down that aspect of the business.
Yeah, so the angle here, of course, is that Google Stadia was meant to be a competitor to gaming consoles. So somebody was going to generate the graphics and rendering. And the idea was is that that rendering would be done in the cloud, and then they would stream down just basically the screen data to your house. And the initial connectivity that was required, I believe, was 20 megabits per second, if I remember rightly. Mm. But that is a lot of bandwidth.
Right.
And if you're going to play some sort of shooter game, it has to be very low latency bandwidth, right? Mm-hmm. Because the video data has to be updated and refreshed. That's why game consoles are popular. High-res video, and the only thing that moves out across the network is data related to where you are in the map and what gun you have, how much ammunition you've got left, and so forth, right?
Right.
So when Google Stadia came out, I think we actually said, you know, the idea that you can process in the cloud would depend on or assume that there is a sufficiently fast network. And so the thing that's on my mind is I don't know what are the reasons for this failure. So Google, you know, pretty well known for shutting down services like starting services that nobody wanted and then shutting them down because nobody wanted them. And it's certainly damaging their reputation. It's quite, you know,
yes.
Google shut down Google Cloud this week.
Right.
Maybe, you know,
right.
It's entirely reasonable. So there's the question here is, was it because they couldn't write games that customers would pay for? Or was it because there's just not enough internet in the world for people to pay money to access those games?
Well, we should be clear that they're not shutting down Stadia. The streaming service is still going forward. They're just not going to make custom games for the service. They're just going to continue to license third-party games. They're just shutting down the gaming studio. They say that Stadia is a going concern going forward.
I find that hard. If, you know, all of the game consoles have an anchor game. Microsoft has Halo, I think it is. You know, and PlayStation has its anchor, you know, the games that run on its console and no one else's. And those in the analyst market, people who talk about the gaming industry talk about how these are absolutely what drives the sales of these consoles. And sometimes people will have all of them, you know, a Microsoft one and a PlayStation one and a Nintendo one or whatever. And because they want those games. So this matters because if Google doesn't have an anchor game that makes people want to buy it, it won't happen. I care because I sort of thought that Stadia, I didn't think it was ever going to work because there's not enough networking in the world to mm-hmm. cope with that. I think mm-hmm. I actually said that during the announcement when we brought it out. But there's some hope that if this took off, then gaming is a big consumer market and this would force telcos to actually upgrade their networks to be faster, especially in the local loop. And Google made a pretty dumb decision to sort of do all of the hosting for Stadia in its data centers. But really what it needs to do is develop an edge computing play. That is, it needs to move the video processing into the telco networks.
Mm.
So, okay, if you're going to say either the network's going to get faster or Google has to distribute the processing out to the edge of the network, so it would literally have to be in the telco data center inside of their network somewhere. Well, telcos aren't there yet.
Right.
So we could hope for that. Like, if you, but that would assume that telcos would have racks and racks of servers that Google could come and put their stuff onto, or that they had data centers and Google would be able to come along and deploy its stuff, like the content delivery network people do. That's a whole transition there. So the question remains, you know, is Stadia too early? That is, will the network speed up? Will Google build an edge compute infrastructure, or will it use somebody else's? Or is this just a dumb idea all along and just get a console and run it locally? I don't know.
Right. Yeah, I don't know either. But at present, Stadia is no longer a game development shop. It's just sticking with streaming mm-hmm. games. So I don't know if you use Stadia. Let us know. We'd be curious to hear what your experience has been.
Mm-hmm.
Let's move on. The U.S. ISP Comcast has struck a deal with Cisco to deliver and install Meraki VPNs for remote workers. The VPN box for Meraki includes switching, routing, Wi-Fi, and there's an option to install a 4G LTE radio to fail over to a cellular connection if the wired service goes down. It's essentially a tidy deal for both companies as remote is currently essential, and we're anticipating that remote work is going to continue after the pandemic as well.
Yeah, I actually, so the thing about this that I foresee, which probably isn't a particularly popular take, is that Cisco's moving away from the reseller market. This is the sort of thing where small businesses would turn to small resellers who would provide them with a VPN solution. And Cisco's now saying, well, why don't I use Comcast, one of my bigger customers, to sell my products for me, and then I don't have to deal with all those resellers. And Meraki can do that. Meraki is a professional services. You know, if you're a reseller, you go and install Meraki, sell it on Cisco's behalf, and Cisco can just go straight out from underneath you and cut you out of the game. And I think this is a step down that direction. Cisco would much rather do business with a few large companies than lots of small companies. They get better margin on large volume deals, and they get one customer. So Comcast is one big customer to deal with. So I actually see this as quite disruptive to the ecosystem as Cisco moves away from resellers, which I've been saying for a while now, and people to keep disagreeing with me and saying, no, resellers are fine, Cisco loves us. Not so sure about that.
I guess the one way I would push back on that is that I don't know there are a lot of resellers that have the ability to get out to the consumer like a Comcast would. So an enterprise, a business might say, I need, you know, to get this box to 1,000 employees, but it's in a Comcast region. And so Comcast is the one I'm going to go to because I don't necessarily know a VAR there.
Yeah, which is fine. Point is, though, not everybody's got a Comcast connection.
Right.
That's why you use resellers, because it might be, you know, you might have some employees in the UK or in Europe or Indonesia, in which case, why would the customer go and deal with Comcast? But at the same time, if you're a small reseller and suddenly Comcast turns up and says, oh, we can take this part of the business out, you'd be a bit sore, I think.
I guess I can see that, yes. Yeah. I guess it's maybe a yellow flag for resellers and not a red flag, but...
Yeah, I would be, you know, thinking carefully about how that works out. But of course, if customers keep buying... if customers keep buying Cisco products, then you'll keep selling them, as every reseller likes to tell me.
That's right. All right, we're going to take a quick break to hear from our sponsor, Nokia. Did you know that Nokia has over 1.1 million routers deployed and powers some of the largest interconnection networks, including Equinix and DECIX? Recently, Nokia launched its data center fabric solution, building on over 20 years of IP know-how and expertise. The new DC Fabric solution includes SR Linux. This is a new, open, extensible, resilient network operating system. It's based on standard Linux, and it's using Nokia's field-proven protocol stacks and provides best-in-class streaming telemetry. There are also interconnect routers. This is a portfolio of Leaf, Spine, and SuperSpine platforms based on merchant silicon from Nokia. And the Fabric Services platform, a declarative, intent-based automation and operations toolkit for day zero, day one, and day two, and ongoing operations. The Fabric Services platform uses Kubernetes and a distributed microservices approach, so you get a true cloud-native automation and operations platform. They've got certified design templates and a digital sandbox to create a true emulation of your data center fabric, so operators can automate their data center networks at scale and speed with confidence. You can check out the new data center fabric solution at nokia.com/networks/dc-fabric. That's nokia.com/networks/dc-fabric. And check out Heavy Networking episode 559. It's the most recent Heavy Networking, where we talked about SR Linux and got some insights into how it came together.
Yeah, I like the approach here. And sort of, it's probably the key feature that came out of the discussion was Nokia didn't develop the product that it thought customers wanted. It actually had a couple of large customers who said, we want a new operating system, but we want it to look like this. So the customers sort of gave them 60 to 80% of what they wanted, and then Nokia took some of its existing stuff, like its proven routing stack and so forth, and then built them on top of a basic Linux containerized API-first type model, which I thought was useful. So maybe it's worth listening to that if you want to think about a different way to do operating systems.
Yeah, that's right. Check it out. All right, back to the news. IBM is reportedly cutting back dramatically on its blockchain business. This is according to the website CoinDesk. The story cites several unnamed former IBM employees, including one who claims that less than 10% of the blockchain team is still working on the product.
So generally, I've always expressed the view that blockchain is comedy technology, and this sort of continues along that vein, but that's not what I'm bringing it out. My view remains that blockchain is a technology that's looking for a problem to solve. Every technology needs a killer solution if it's going to survive, if that makes sense. Mm-hmm. Do you agree with that sort of statement?
Oh, sure. Absolutely.
Yeah, there needs to be something. And what we've had up until now is a couple of useful niche applications of the technology. But after 10 years, there's still no killer application. Now, Bitcoin's use of blockchain has nothing to do with how useful it is or valuable it is, because you could just as easily agree that bits of paper or chunks of gold or tulip bulbs, whatever, right, has value, and then you go on and trade them. And that's what Bitcoin is. The fact that it's run on a blockchain is not really an assertion that the technology is valuable. It just happens to run on a blockchain, which allowed it to be perceived as having value. So as long as people perceive it as having value, it's got value. If it doesn't, then it won't. The advantage of blockchain is that it removes the intermediary. So for most of us, when we do banking, when you get a piece of paper, then say it's worth $100 or whatever, you're trusting on a bank behind it. And the value of blockchain is that you're allowed to remove the intermediaries in various commercial transactions. And we've seen some of that. So for example, here in the UK, there's a thing called the Check Clearing Company. And its job is for when you used to deposit checks in all the sides, and they would sit in the middle. And at the end of the day, the banks would say, I got this many checks from this bank. And the other bank would say, I got this many checks for your bank. And then if there was a difference, they would agree to send the money to the check clearing company, who would then pay it through to the other bank. Mm-hmm. If you had a blockchain for that, you don't need the intermediary, right? Because you could put the transaction on the blockchain. The other side could put their transaction on the blockchain and agree. So if blockchain is about removing intermediaries, useful but not inherently valuable, right? It's not like C or Linux or something. It's not a world-changing experience.
The thing is, I think that the killer application for blockchain is cryptocurrency. And then IBM tried to take the blockchain and say, well, we can use it for other services, like trying to, you know, have a distributed ledger system that you can trust for your supply chain, for working with a bunch of suppliers. We can use the blockchain to track, products being shipped through the supply chain, and everybody can verify it, and it's all distributed and safe and encrypted. But so far, that's apparently been a hard sell for IBM. They went in with a lot of enthusiasm about blockchain as a supply chain solution, and doesn't seem like they've gotten a lot of uptake.
Mm. And keep in mind, other companies are doing it as well. VMware's got a blockchain product, and there are enterprises out there deploying VMware for a blockchain.
Right. I mean, the thing about blockchain is that it's supposed to be distributed trust, but a lot of enterprises may not want the idea that IBM said was, we'll sort of be the trusted intermediary to set up a blockchain for everyone that a big company could feel comfortable using. And I guess whatever other benefits from blockchain there might be weren't enough to get companies to sign on. Although I will say that IBM replied to CoinDesk and said, quote, our blockchain business is doing well. We have realigned some leaders and business units to continue to drive growth. So IBM says it's fine.
But 90% of staff is not is a little bit of an over. You might have overset your expectations, perhaps, or, you thought it was going to be.
Right.
I remain sort of sanguine about the whole blockchain thing. Definitely it's useful. Yes. There are companies using blockchain as a distributed ledger database. But, at the end of the day, a single transaction on Bitcoin uses, I think it's 10,000 times the power of a Visa transaction.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Mm-hmm. Literally carbonizing, ecological disaster levels of power consumption to do a Bitcoin contraction. Right. And it takes hours, not seconds. Whereas, if you walk up to the shop and say, here's a Bitcoin transaction, they say, good, come back in 4 hours when the transaction's been validated and we'll give you goods, right? So the technology isn't all that. Anyway, enough on blockchain.
Yeah. Links in the show notes if you want to find out more. Moving on, code changes to Chromium. That's the engine that powers search engines such as Google Chrome and Microsoft Edge, has cut DNS root server queries by 41%, or approximately 60 billion queries a day. That's according to researchers at VeriSign, who announced their findings in early January.
We talked about this. Apnik published a blog post on it, which pointed to the VeriSign research about how vast the load was on the root DNS servers. And this week, Google Chrome obviously listened without saying that they were listening and published a patch that actually rolls this back. And what was happening was, in the internet, it was creating a random domains and then doing lookups. Uh-huh. And if the domain testing went out to the internet, then it would say, oh, I can see that there's no intranet, or the DNS isn't being captured, or the web's not being captured. Of course, we know a lot of DNS providers like to use NX domain records to capture you and send you to an advertising portal.
Right.
If you look up an invalid domain name, they send you to an advertising portal as a way of hijacking the user and monetizing them.
And it was right, and I guess that's the feature this was trying to prevent in Chromium, was preventing NX domains redirects. But it also resulted in a ton of hits on the root DNS servers, yeah.
Yeah, it's just one of those things. People don't think through, I've got a solution, I'll implement it, there you go, it works, I test the code, it's quality and not. A problem with a lot of these open, free and open resources is that they get abused. I imagine Google's DNS server gets abused a lot too, like DNS lookups and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. So it's just one of those things where people services that are free and open are often abused, but the service that is provided on the root DNS, somebody has to pay for them.
Right.
And so, yeah.
Yeah, cutting the load by 60 billion queries a day is going to be significant.
Yeah, I've got a chart here. You can see it. It's astonishing.
All right, a few more stories to go before we wrap. First, a quick note, a space networking update. Starlink has launched 10 satellites into polar orbits that will have laser links to provide coverage over the poles.
Yeah, I always love space networking because it's really interesting to me, especially from an SD-WAN point of view. And we talked about in the early days of Starlink, we discussed at length the idea that the satellite network that they were putting up would be a full mesh using laser links between sites and radio links down to the ground. And the early constellations did not have them, but this week's launch into polar orbits does have lasers. And of course it has to because it has no land component.
Right.
So if you're trying to network, say, from the UK to the US, the signal goes up to a satellite and the satellite has to send it back down to a ground station before it sends it back up to a satellite and then back down to a ground station before it reaches the US. And it might go through two or three hops, and that's relatively slow. The units in polar orbit are there have to have lasers, of course, because no ground stations.
Right.
But it's necessary to provide coverage to the countries in the northern latitudes. They absolutely have to be in that place. So most likely this means that it is they are progressing. So they put the lasers up, did some stuff with them, put the first satellites up, probably to meet regulatory requirements. We promised we were sending up satellites, put enough satellites in there they could say, hey, we did what we said. They weren't workable. But then again, there's a blog post this week from somebody called Tom Veslin who talks about his personal experience of deploying a Starlink, and he's basically saying it's pretty good.
Yeah, better than nothing. And actually, it sounds much better than nothing, but there's a link in the show notes if you want to check it out.
He was saying that he's getting a latency of 20 to 60 milliseconds. That's a bit variable, but that's pretty fast by comparison. He's getting variable bandwidth between 30 and 130 megabits per second for downloads and between 20 and 40 megabits per second with occasional outages. However, Starlink says you may see occasional outages during our beta phase, so okay. He said that he's paying about $100 a month and $600 for the first to buy the kit.
Right.
So that's pretty much on par with the US market, as I understand it. Drew, you'd know better than me, but $100 a month for some good internet bandwidth is not unreasonable.
It is not, no, depending on where you are. Yeah, for sure.
Bit steep for the UK market, but, you know, okay. So, as I noted, priced well for the US market. And then Elon disclosed this week that he has over 10,000 users in the United States and abroad. So on the whole, you know, seems like they're delivering at this point in time.
I have to say I was initially skeptical about Starlink and space networking, but I'm coming around. Maybe there is actually something here.
Yeah, and you have to be careful with billionaire promises. They tend to
absolutely,
especially Silicon Valley billionaire promises. They promise a lot, and you know, to try and get you interested, to make a lot of noise.
Mm-hmm. And Elon Musk is amazing at that.
Yeah, and so a little bit of caution is always good. So we'll see.
Yes, but the fact is, I mean, we've talked about this before. The U.S. has a serious problem with lack of access to broadband network. So if Starlink can actually pull it off, tip of the hat. So we'll see. Mm-hmm. All right, two stories on financial results. First, Amazon reported its fourth quarter and full year results, and our eyes are on AWS, the AWS part of Amazon's business. For the fourth quarter, AWS posted net sales of $12.7 billion, up 28% year over year. However, that sales number missed Wall Street estimates, and while 28% growth might sound good, that number has been inching down since 2018.
Yeah, I think the part about the AWS is interesting because it means AWS is give or take 5 to 10%, the same size as Cisco is now. So $12 to $13 billion a quarter, $2.6 billion in revenue, roughly where Cisco sits in the market itself. So AWS taken 10 to 12 years to reach the same size as Cisco, not a competitor, of course, but to just give you a sense of how successful they've been renting out cloud services. Keep in mind, they invested a lot of money in the company. They'd be sitting on a lot of debt after building out their portfolio. They had a lot of capital, a lot of R&D to get where they are. So the profit's a little bit nominal, but notwithstanding, AWS is now, give or take, the same size as Cisco.
Yeah, for the full year, they had net sales of $45.3 billion. So that's right around Cisco's $40 billion or so,
Yeah, Cisco's around 40, fluctuates between 46 and 49.
Yeah.
depending on a few things over the last 5 to 10 years, hasn't gone up. They can't get growth, but very popular because of their profitability. They pay dividends, which makes them popular with investors.
Right.
But, you know, that was just something that I wanted to note. And, of course, AWS CEO Andy Jassy, you've probably all heard it, is taking over as the CEO of Amazon while Jeff Bezos steps down.
Well, he's stepping up to executive chair. I don't know what that means in terms of his day-to-day involvement in the company, but I assume he'll still be around.
I always felt he checked out anyway. He had put a lot of managers in place and just let them run the company, their parts in the company themselves. Mm-hmm. He might have been involved directly in a few things. He might stand further back. But at this point, what's he got to prove? I think he wants to play Rockets, and he's got various other play projects, and he spends most of his time doing those.
My assumption, he's going to put more effort into the Blue Origins or Blue Planet or whatever his space ambitions are now that he's stepped back a little bit.
Yeah, people's the results that came out of Amazon were a bit different. People reacted differently. So when I go and read the analyst stuff, some of them are bullish, some of them are negative. Typical Amazon, it polarizes opinion one way or the other. The one guy's saying, oh, the company's deterred, it's doomed, I tell you, doomed. They're flatlining growth, revenue's down, everything's going against them. And then another person pops up and says, brilliant, the share price is going up to trillions of dollars. And so we're not going to make any predictions there. We'll just say Amazon did great and will continue to do great.
Yeah, I think so. That's probably a safe prediction. All right, one more result, also cloud-related. Google parent company Alphabet announced Q4 and full-year results, and in particular, the Google Cloud business. That business had fourth-quarter revenues of $3.8 billion, up 47% year-over-year, and full-year revenues of just over $13 billion. However, Google is still spending more than it makes on its cloud service. Google Cloud lost $5.6 billion for the full year of 2020, and those losses have gone up every year over the past 3 years.
That's astonishing, isn't it?
It really is.
But the suggestion is that other cloud companies have invested similar sums to build up their infrastructure. So there is a way to look at cloud companies and say, we have to invest $20, $40, $60, $100 billion to be cloud companies. Yeah. And if we don't, someone else will. So we'll get there. So, you know, we saw in the early days, HP and Cisco and Dell all thought they were going to be cloud companies. But there were other people out there basically willing to outspend them.
Yep.
And which is, you know, not much you can say about that.
Yeah. Well, the thing is, Google overall, its search and YouTube businesses bring in so much money that Google can't afford to just throw money at Google Cloud and watch it pile up the losses as long as they're seeing growth, which at 47% year over year they are. And there's a note from CEO Sundar Pichai in their earnings call. He said, I am very pleased with the progress here. We will continue making disciplined investments to scale the business and improve profitability. That's in regard to Google Cloud. So it seems like, yeah, full steam ahead for Google Cloud.
Yeah, but then this comes back to like Stadia. You know, they come out with a big splash, big marketing campaign, and then suddenly say, oh, bored
with
that.
The iron around Google's leg is their willingness to kill businesses. And so you got to wonder how much that's hurting them with Google Cloud.
Yeah, I do. I really do. And, you know, that reputation comes over. But then again, you know, $5 billion in losses means they're building out their infrastructure and costs a lot of money to run those data centers worldwide, even if they're not being used. So I guess that's just the way they have it.
Yep. All right. Links in the show notes if you want to go look at the data for yourself. That does wrap up our news portion. Stay tuned for a sponsored conversation with Infoblox about NetMRI. That's the network configuration and change management product. That's coming right up. Welcome to the Tech Bytes podcast. We're sponsored today by Infoblox. We're going to explore Infoblox's NetMRI, a network management tool with a variety of capabilities, including device discovery and network topology mapping, configuration monitoring, change management, and more. Our guests are Ingmar Van Glabeek, he's senior product manager at Infoblox, and Adam Fox, solution architect at Empowered Networks. Ingmar and Adam, welcome to the podcast. And can you give us a quick overview of NetMRI and what it does for folks who might not be familiar?
Absolutely. Happy to be on. So NetMRI is an NCCM tool. That means it's a network change configuration management tool. It allows you to discover and manage your network as well as deal with configuration policy compliance.
So network change and compliance, right? So this is this sort of, I've got a configuration, I've made a change, I can review it. Or is this more of a actually doing the change for me? Let's just dig into that a little bit. NCCM is pretty well known, but let's make sure everybody understands.
Yeah, so it works on both sides, right? So we talk to all the network devices that are out there. We build an inventory of the entire network equipment that you have running. We capture like all the SNMP, CLI, HTTP API data that we can. And based on that inventory, we then allow you to turn around and run automation jobs against it. So it's not just seeing the changes and allowing you to look at the details, but it also allows you to automate and really amplify your efficiency, making those changes against the network.
So it's also a source of truth. So we see a lot of people talking that they're doing automation. They want to have a centralized repository of configurations, of known state in the network, someplace where all of the different vendor devices send all of their data, so that if I'm going to run an automation or an Ansible script or a Python or, you know, whatever, I don't have to go around holding multiple databases and multiple configurations. Is it in that vein?
Yeah, it definitely serves that purpose. One of the main points about NetMRI is that we are absolutely vendor agnostic. So we will talk to anything, anyone. We have an enormous list of supported devices, models, and versions, and that is continuously being expanded. And that is really something where we pride ourselves in, that we just build that source of truth, that single place where you can find it all, and then you can use that in any way, shape, or form you want. If you are like a more traditional, like I want to CLI into something and execute commands, you can. But if you want to use that for further automation and you say, okay, well, what do configs look like? How can I tack this on top of or add this to other workflows like Ansible? Then it offers the APIs into all that data as well.
Mm-hmm. It's very, very well put as a source of authority, like you mentioned, Greg. It's yeah. What we see a lot of clients using this as a trusted initiator as well. So we see a lot of people integrating NetMRI, that source of truth, with their ITSM, CMDB systems, so forth and so on. Mm-hmm. And they actually use that as a trusted initiator as well, because it's wise enough to know what's on your network and any new devices being added to that network. We're able to really make it part of a growing ecosystem. And just to bring it back to the NCCM, you know, how does it kind of differ itself, and what is kind of better about NetMRI? It sets, it tests, and it enforces policy. So it's kind of those three things. It sets, tests, and enforces. And one of the things that makes it vastly different than its competitors is its discovery engine. It has a really slick discovery engine underneath the hood. So instead of doing Nmaps or ping scans, you know, a lot of different vendors will do discovery like that. It uses what I call the tell me about your friend protocol. So it'll actually connect to a device and say, give me your, you know, your CDP neighbors, your LLDP neighbors, anything with an IP address, let me know about it. And then I will use that to enrich my discovery. So it is the source of authority, but it's also really dynamic how it works underneath the hood. And we've seen a lot of clients integrate very successfully with ITSM systems like ServiceNow, Jira, so forth.
You talked a little bit about enforcement there. That's interesting to me. So what you're saying there is, if I see a change and it doesn't meet some sort of policy or template or configuration standard, you're actually able to alert on that, or to do what with it?
Exactly. It's what we always recommend is, you know, you want to take it in steps, especially because people need to respect their change management requirements. So we always recommend people start monitoring for the change, you know, test it. But then what they're able to do is, of course, alert on a violation. But there's some low-hanging fruit, or sometimes you need to act really quickly. Low-hanging fruit would be something like an SNMP community string. I don't need to do a lot of change paperwork for that. So I can use the triggered job framework in NetMRI. It's very easy to do. It says, when you see X, respond with Y. So X would be my monitor looking for the bad config, and Y would be a remediation script or a remediation template that's automatically going to either revert that change or do something to that configuration, however you want it to be treated. So with SNMP, we see a lot of clients, basic example, we see a lot of clients enable that automation just to act immediately. They do the paperwork after the fact. And sometimes we also see it with things that are a little more advanced, like perimeter firewalls and ACLs. If someone's changing an ACL outside of a change management window, you don't want to necessarily wait for the paperwork to snap that back, right? That could be a hostile actor increasing the attack footprint.
So if somebody's suddenly doing something at 2 o'clock in the morning, and that's not in and you're running an ITSM sort of operational process, which says changes don't happen outside of these hours, you've got ways to either alert and then act, or whatever. There's flexibility inside of that capability.
Exactly. Yeah,
we have seen customers that are implementing this in some sort of a two-stage way as well. where if they detect something that they have like an automatic remediation for, it detects, it remediates, and then it checks if the remediation was successful. And if that check fails, then it gets escalated to like a human interface or to a human interaction.
And that probably reflects the nature of Net MRI in the sense that it's very mature. This is a product that's been around for a decade or more.
And that one of the things beyond being vendor agnostic, it also will go back the entire line. So just as an example, a vendor like Cisco, there's some solutions that are going to address their more recent releases and then kind of their earlier ones, where NetMRI is going to be able to manage the entire life cycle of a vendor like that because it's been in the field so long. It knows how to interact with, you know, CLI, SSH, all the way up to what they're introducing now with things like software-defined networking and API interactions.
So you remember the old switches and how to make them actually extract configurations over 10-year-old switches and things like that.
Exactly.
Absolutely. And I think that is also something to take into account when looking at like tools that you put on your network. Specifically, if you have like 10-year-old switches in your network, is how do you know that the tools you use are going to be aware of them and then are going to have some knowledge about their intricacies? One example there is that there's a ton of historic iOS versions with issues around SNMP polling causing impact on the device. And because of the maturity of the product, we really have that down to a science. So we know these issues and we filter them out so that we don't cause any problems on the network. Because again, if you have something that is in a critical position and all of a sudden you have a weird SNMP query being made, now you peg the CPU to 100% and you have an outage.
Speaking of network impact, something that's really important to consider as well. I've worked 15 years in the monitoring space. And before I rolled out a new monitor or made any changes to the software, I really had to consider what type of impact I was going to make. With NetMRI, when you're evaluating configs and you're evaluating the state of things, it's referencing its local database. So it doesn't need to be going out and bang up against your network when you're trying to push out new policies, when you're trying to evaluate different rules. It's all referring to itself because it has a live copy of your running configurations. So you're able to do a lot of these activities without having to worry about impacting the network at all.
How often are configurations updated, or how often is it polling or gathering information?
So that's another part where we try to be as smart as we can. So we will try at least once a day to validate a config and gather the data, but it depends on the device type. And it also has the ability to ingest SNMP traps and syslog data from your network devices. And then we trigger on change. So if we see somebody making changes to a device, at that moment, we will go in and we will fetch the diff in the config. And that also allows us to attribute changes to users without having to look at your AAA solution or go dig through other authorization logs. Mm-hmm. It really shows you exactly, okay, at this moment, Adam made the following change on this device. And then from that perspective, having the ability to just click one button to roll back to before the change, I think that's pretty powerful.
Yeah. So are you able to, a lot of configs are actually quite complicated. They go one way. That is, when you make a configuration change going forward, you can't just say undo the change, or you can't know that configuration step. You actually have to do multiple steps. Are you able to handle that and to understand how to roll back configurations intelligently?
Well, so what we have in there is really like the versioning between the configs allows us to just push the entire file as the full config back to it. So if you make a change and you would need multiple steps to back that out, that is one way. But if you would just wipe the config and push the N-1 version of it, then you would be back in that original state.
Right.
Indeed. There are buttons within the configuration view. There are buttons to perform an immediate rollback as well. But what we'll usually see, like you said, it's a multi-part change, right? Someone might make a change, save the config, so forth and so on. It's going to capture each of those diffs, and you actually have the ability to, whenever there's an outage, you know, change is usually the leading cause. But having this diff engine, you're really able to look in and say, okay, this was the change that could have actually impacted service. You know, changing the SNMP polling string isn't gonna mess up my ACLs. So you're able to actually, instead of rolling all the way back to, you know, the five changes you made, you could look at each individual change and intelligently say, this is the change I need to negate.
Now, this is kind of topical at the moment because we've had a recent well-known vulnerability called SolariGate, where another product, which is in this same space of this network configuration change management type capability, where they'll give you the historical sort of thing. This is an inflection point where a lot of people have suddenly been challenged to look at this, what the tools that they're doing this. Are you seeing a lot of activity as a result of that and based around the fact that they need to reconsider what's the right tool for the job?
Yeah, we've seen definitely an uptick in like people looking at NetMRI for that purpose. And so absolutely, we're definitely ready to accommodate these use cases and these switches.
Right.
And from a security point of view, one of the things that differentiates NetMRI from a lot of the different competitors is it's a contained solution, extremely extensible. You're still able to interact with it via API and get all the information out in a very secure way, but it's a sealed solution. So you don't need to be managing databases, and it's not as much as a, let's just say, it's not as much of an attack surface available to some of the other competitors out there.
Right. So you're alluding to the fact that NetMRI is also partly part of a company that is security focused these days. You're not just a company that makes management products and they're safe because they sit in a management zone. You're alluding to the fact that Infoblox is a security company too these days.
Indeed. Infoblox is works with some really, really big names, a lot of the very secure agencies, and they have to conform to very, very strict requirements.
Hmm. And that's part of you've got a very long history in the government, like working for the federal government and meeting the requirements and things like that. So a lot of those security things that you might want to ask are probably solved inside those. So I want to dig a bit more into this idea of automating network changes. Is this really just about you're going to write configurations that I give it? Are you giving me some sort of intelligence assistance or some sort of capabilities to identify the configurations for me? Is it just that? How's that work?
Yeah, so it's a complex picture, right? So we allow you to build that inventory of your devices and then just make changes to them, right-click SSH to device and off you go. But we also give you the ability to create these jobs, which are like little snippets of config statements or commands that you want to push. And then that you can tie that into your automation workflows. So we have a workflow in there where you say, for example, hey, anybody can push these out, but nobody can approve their own changes. And so that gives a much better quality of changes and at least having two sets of eyes on each change. And then you can take it a step further and go really into the like scripting that is native on the appliance. So you just write a script in one of the three following languages. There's CCS, which is like a proprietary but extremely simple scripting language that is geared towards like pushing config statements and dealing with the CLI output as you get it. But we also actually support full Perl and Python natively on the environment. So you can take that complexity really to a level where in your automation jobs and as you push changes to devices on the network,
right,
you leverage other APIs and other systems.
So if I've got a bunch of Python scripts that my team use regularly, I can leverage those with NetMRI?
Yeah, you can just import those straight into the product and start running them from the platform, which also gives you actually a good single source of truth, again, for those scripts that are being used to manage your network. They don't reside on five engineers and their computers anymore, right, or in this repo where everybody has their own branch.
And that can be helpful, you know, if somebody leaves the organization or whatever, they don't take all that sort of working knowledge with them if you've got that one repository for everything.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely.
And just to add to that, of course, there's a couple mechanisms you can make changes within NetMRI. The templating aspect of it, you don't need to be a developer. You don't need to know Python, although we'd recommend you learn Python. It's becoming very prevalent in the networking space. But you're able to do templates, which is just networking commands. And then with the Python scripting, even you're like, oh, Python seems a bit heavy to me. It's not. Because Infoblox created the NetMRI Easy package, when you look at the Python script, it gives you the Boolean logic of Python. You're able to say if this, then that. But when you actually look at the commands it's implementing, they are just networking commands. So you do not need to be a developer. Any network engineer is going to be able to embrace this system and run with it, especially when it comes to onboarding. Like you mentioned, a lot of the time you'll have some key employees, some really, you know, really smart individuals, and they'll move on with their career. And then you're kind of left holding the bag, uh-huh, trying to figure out what the heck was going on and how did they ever make this work. With NetMRI, you're not gonna run into that because it's a really easy to understand interface that you don't need to be a developer to do awesome automated things with.
So one last question before we wrap. There's a lot of folks moving to SDN, SD-WAN, lots of overlays and new ways of doing networking. Is NetMRI relevant here?
Yeah, so we actually added a completely new API-based discovery engine to the product. And so that allows us to extend that multi-vendor support to controller-based and API-based engines. And so there we've been adding some SDN and SD-WAN vendors, and we're looking to increase that there.
Okay, fantastic. So if you've piqued anybody's interest in NetMRI, Ingmar, where would you send them to get more details?
Well, I think the proof in the pudding is eating it, right? Go to infobox.com/techbytes, and there you can get an eval running. So that means that you'll just get the VM, OVA, or QCOW, and you can run that on your environment so that you can spin it up, test it out, and give it a go.
All right, so take it for a test drive. That's infoblox.com/techbytes. That does wrap up our time. So thank you, Ingmar and Adam. And thanks to Infoblox for being a sponsor. You can find this and many more fine, free technical podcasts along with our community blog at packetpushers.net. You can follow us on Twitter at packetpushers. Find us on LinkedIn, like us on Facebook, and rate us on Apple Podcasts. And last but not least, remember that too much networking would never be enough.